Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with the Kia Dealers of Ireland. Our showrooms are open for business with your health and safety our priority. For more, log on to kia.com.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Wash your hands. On this Bank Holiday Friday, we decided to ask one of the radio greats, Brendan Balfe, to come in and pick, over the next 75 minutes, pick his highlights from whatever era he likes, but and a mixture, because Brendan Balfe has been broadcasting for over 50 years. He's only 54 and a half. He's regularly produced radio and television programmes illustrating the cultural and social history of Ireland. An unrivalled knowledge of the RTE archives, as well as first-hand experience of Irish audience from his days as an announcer, presenter, producer, scriptwriter, writer, author and performer. He has worked extensively in RTE radio and television, commercial radio, as a trainer and lecturer in broadcasting, and as a communications consultant. He is an all-round good guy. I can't read your handwriting all the way there, Brendan, but how are you, Brendan Balfe?
Well, thank you, John. I'm very well, thank you, and good for and yourself.
I'm good, thanks. Yeah. And 2RN, the name of the station when it opened in 1926, it's the number two. Just for a younger, it's a number two, and it's the letters RN. Yeah. What does it mean, Brendan?
Well, it was given to us by the British Post Office, because they still had that particular role, even though we were independent.
Yeah.
But the feeling seems to be that it was based on the song "Come Back 2RN." And it was a little nod towards the Irish cousins. That's all it was.
And but is that the first ever predictive? Don't know about the kids texty day,
yeah,
too.
Must be.
2RN. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Your first choice.
First choice is Neil Tobin, one of the many big people we lost in the last some months, Gay, yeah, and Larry and Marion and Neil Tobin and Dale Smith and everyone. But this one, I'll tell you the story here. Neil was a member of the Ready Round Players, of course,
yes.
And a fine. And if you listen to a radio play and you can't quite grab which accent it is, it's always Neil Tobin. You couldn't figure out which of them it was. And I remember on my very first day as an announcer, I went down to announce the Sunday play, which you do in between the 10 o'clock and the 1 o'clock opening. And it was just Raddy Warren, we present an enemy of the people. And I had to read about a full page at sight of the scene set. The action takes place. Oh, man, I didn't know I had to do that too. And Wogan was with me, because Wogan was my
Terry,
boss.
Yeah.
Terry is the chief announcer. So in you go there, and you come back an hour and a half later and do the closing. And I came back to do the closing announcement, and I went to the producer, said, you can nip inside. We're not using any music. We're ending on Neil Tobin there. And just take a pause and then do. That was enemy of the people. I didn't know there's a very famous floorboard in the studio of Studio 10, the Drama Suite, that creaks if you're not sure of it. And I found it.
Okay.
And Neil was in full flight, and I went, eek! And he threw down the script and said, for fact's sake, who's that? Who? And it was roaring. And I nearly collapsed. I actually had an awful flight. And using many words I'd never heard before. And more or less, and so eventually I said, I got it, John. I got out, shame-faced, red-faced. I said, this is my first day.
Yeah.
And this is how it's going to start. Anyway, he came down a day later and said, I'm terribly sorry. Just a little bit. I know you just want to get it right, Neil. You're an actor, you want to make the best performance, and I got in the way, and terribly sorry. And we're best pals ever since that. So sometime after that, the piece we're going to play now, it arrived because I was producing the in-flight audio for the Jumbo Jets, the very first one that came on in 1971 or something. And the magazine program, and it wanted something to do with Irish accents for the American people coming over here. If we ever see them again, we never know.
Yes.
But I said to Neil, how about something like maybe a Shakespeare speech done in different accents? That sort of illustration. And, well, I'll write something up. I'll get something organized. And he did this piece, and it was a superb piece. And he did it. I thought it was super. I played it for Gabo because I was producing Gay's sponsor programs. He said, listen to this. Isn't this wonderful? And why don't you bring him on the Late Late Show? So he brought him on the Late Late Show that following Friday, and Noel Pearson happened to be in the audience, and Noel Pearson and Neil Tobin made an arrangement whereby Neil Tobin became a comedian.
Wow.
And it started
cue
with
it
this.
Up there, yeah.
For its size, Ireland has an astonishing diversity of scenery, surpassed only by its bewildering diversity of accents. Some of these no actor would attempt without adequate insurance coverage. But allow me to try a conducted tour of the Irish voice. Time now, gentlemen, please. A Belfast man who owned my local pub used to shout at closing time. Come on now, why do I have to shout so loud to try to clear the house before anyone makes a move? I thought he was laying it on a bit, till the place itself, and found that he was only a pale imitation of the real thing. If you slope down the east coast, you hit Dundalk and Drogheda. Drogheda, Nardi, and the hinterland can be lumped with Monaghan, accent-wise, very broadly, of course, that is. O stony grey soil of Monaghan, the laugh from my love ye thieved, ye took the gay child of me passion and gave me your clod conceived. Ye flung a ditch on my vision of beauty, love and truth. O stony grey soil of Monaghan, you burgled my bank of youth. Cavan, of course, is only geographically contiguous to this region. A Cavan man once told me, the Harvish moon, he said, is the brightest moon of the year. Which is probably true. And then there's the Midlands. And no doubt they take great offence the way we lumped them all together, but that's the way the story is. You could travel vocally all the way from Mullingar through Westmead and Offaly and Leash and parts of Carlow and even North Tipperary and even take in an odd corner of Kildare and you'd hardly go through three notes at a scale in any octave, whatever the hell that is. Of course, the best English is spoken in Dublin. You know that. Oh, yes, that's admitted all over the world, you know. Well, all over Dublin, anyway. But, of course, that claim has a certain amount of truth in it because it referred, of course, originally to the type of English that I speak rather than to the type of English spoken by lower-class people, the gorriers, as we would call them. Did you hear him? I'll tell you one thing, he's not a Dublin man. Now, that's enough. There's no more Dublin accents getting give out on this programme. If you draw a line from Waterford City through South Kilkenny, South Tipperary, North Cork, Limerick, North Kerry, and into Clare, you will have successfully lassoed a whole herd of uvular R's. Now, this uvular R, being easily the most intriguing single consonant in the English language as it is justifiably abused in the Islands of Saints. It is, among other rather more questionable things, reputedly a legacy of the Norman invasion. Of course, the best English is spoken in Cork. I mean, that's universally accepted. Of course. Should I mean anyone understand the way we talk? Yeah, but I was at an international match last year and I was taken for a Welshman. Imagine that, a fella tried to persuade me that Cork people talk like Welshmen. And where do you live, Galway? I'd say Galway had the nicest and softest of all Irish accents. Except, of course, when we're roused. Did you ever hear about the cute Kerry man? A tailor he was. And he wanted to order two of the type of iron known as a tailor's goose. You know, it's for pressing cloth and iron. But what's the plural of goose in that case? Is it geese or gooses? So after long pondering, he wrote his order. Dear sir, please forward one tailor's goose. P.S. As you're sending one, sure you might as well send another one along with it.
Brilliant. Neil Tobin. OK, Dennis Meehan, the man who discovered Brendan Bath, Gay Bourne, Mike Murphy. He's a lot to answer for.
Terry Wogan. Morris O'Doherty.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, he was the called station supervisor, which is the head of presentation, okay, essentially, and chief announcer. Wogan was the chief announcer at the time because he said, we have to find a way of giving him a few extra bob, and that's the way that made him chief announcer, yeah, which means he trained us as well.
Terry Wogan.
Wogan did, yeah, he trained. I mean, on my first day, he poured a jug of water on my head on my first live announcement. I was dripping from the nose down at the page. Dennis Meehan was a lovely man, and he died. He had grey hair, no harm in that, I hear.
Right.
But he looked much. He died about 5 years after that, and he was only 42.
Wow.
Yeah. We didn't. No, he looked like he was 65, apparently. But lovely, lovely voice.
So he was in the GP when RTE Radio was in the GPO.
In the GPO, yeah. And he would have been one of the old Ratty Warren voices,
okay,
the anonymous voice you would hear between the programmes. I remember when we were being trained. The training class I was with, people like Frank Delaney and Valerie McGovern and Diane Lonigan and Nuala Robinson and other people. And we remember, and it was 8 weeks, 6 nights a week. So 5 nights a week for 8 weeks, we could train, and then we could final auditions. And I got the job as a casual announcer. But I remember one thing always stood by me. We were all coming in and we were getting a little bit late and a little bit unpunctual. And Dennis said, I remember saying, what is the first requisite of a continuity announcer? And we said, nice voice. Cool in a crisis. Yeah. Knowledge of Irish. Yeah. All good things to have. But the first requisite of an announcer is to be there.
And is this Dennis Meehan's voice in this?
It is Dennis Meehan's voice.
Okay.
It must happen that the faith people have in our omniscience must, again, I insist, especially at night, be occasionally misplaced. But even more likely, it may often, very often, be that we have other things to do, such as broadcasting, for instance. In continuity, it can and does happen that we'll have to say to a caller, excuse me now, I have to make an announcement. This has the gratifying effect of dumbfounding some callers. When the announcement is heard, both on the radio and faintly on the still live telephone simultaneously, it at least engenders the conviction that we are at work. I think every broadcaster worthy of the name would agree that in all situations, we must have as our fundamental working basis the fact that we're providing a service to the public. This means that supervisors on duty and announcers must be at all times patient, courteous, cheerful. But none of these obligations can come between us and our duty to attend to the primary service we're providing, the broadcast of Radio Television's programmes. That said, I should be very sorry to miss this immediate link with you that the telephone often provides. Even if occasionally I have to tell someone that, no, I'm very sorry, I can't audition him or her in singing over the telephone, I cannot allow that to blot out the fact that a man once rang me from Liverpool to check on the spelling of a word. In the human condition, glory such as this cannot be lightly forgone.
Now, why do I hear Myles Na Gcapallóna, Flann O'Brien in that structure?
Yes, because Dennis's thesis when he went through college was on the great Irish fantasists, James Stephens, Flann O'Brien and others. And if you want to figure out where Wogan got his bizarre and slightly surreal sense of humor, from Dennis.
Wow.
He used to have these extraordinary conversations about nothing at all. where do you leave the chilli crop and bananas gone up fourpence in Montevideo? Isn't that a fright? And it goes on from there.
And you credit him. You credit this man, Dennis Meehan, who died at 42. I didn't know, never met him. But you credit him with modernising Irish radio.
Very much so, because when the Ratty Warren Authority came about with the coming of television in 1961, the Department of Post and Telegraphs had to go. So there was a much freer attitude. And I think Dennis let in the light.
Wow.
He wanted, you didn't have to be a tenor. But all the announcers were tenors, if you like.
What do you?
Morris was a bass profundo. He was a very bass.
Morris was hard, yeah. We'd hear him later on.
And Mike was a casual announcer, and I was sort of slightly friendly and casual. And Valerie McGovern came in, and she sounded like a woman next door. She sounded like somebody who he'd chat to, and eased it all up. And he'd one great motto. He more or less said, you know, respect the listener. Yeah. We are providing a service. Respect the listener.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, they may be ill-informed or are lacking in knowledge, but they're not stupid.
Okay.
And my motto has always been, assume they're bright. Start there. Assume they get the subtleties sometimes.
Yeah.
Assume they're bright. Start there.
Okay.
And I always, someone said, you know, about listening figures, I would go for the IQ. Pick an IQ target, a name for that one. Never mind the ABC ones and everything else.
You know, okay.
So assume they got a brain. That's where you start.
Okay, you're listening to Liveline. It's the Bank Holiday Friday. We've been prompted. By the way, 2FM.
Yes.
First broadcast 41 years ago on Sunday.
Good Lord.
The quiz question always asks, who was the first voice on 2FM? And everyone says,
Larry Gogan,
the wonderful Larry. But it wasn't. It was?
Brendan Belt.
It was yourself. What did you say?
I said the time was 23 minutes to 1 o'clock and to present Pop Around Ireland. Here is Larry Gogan.
Okay. And you were the first voice in colour, so to speak.
Yeah.
In a colour broadcast on RT television.
Right. That's right. That was when we were doing the show, the Eurovision from the Gaiety. I used to introduce it. I was the panel scorer, if you like.
Okay.
And Tom McGraw, the producer, said they're now doing videos of the forthcoming songs, first year, and they need to be introduced before the show starts in a few weeks. So I did them from Studio 3, which is still black and white. So we dragged in the outside broadcast unit and ran the camera up two flights of stairs, down the corridor, and I appeared to say, and the entry from Sweden is this, and was the first face in colour.
Irish television.
Yeah, they've done race meetings and things outside.
Yeah, but you were the first. Then you were the last voice on RTE Radio Medium Wave.
I was, yeah.
What was that, Brendan?
That was only in recent years, 2008, when we closed our Medium Wave. And I did a thing called Medium Wave Goodbye, which is taking, not unlike these things here, some of the big hits from Irish radio. And some of the songs that meant something, and some of the weird people you met, and some people should have been in enclosed communities.
As we are now,
I'm very proud to say that I opened Radio 2 and closed Radio 1.
And just in this section, the 24-hour broadcast you did. What was that, Brendan?
That was the end of the century. That was the 1999 to 2000. Helen Shaw, the director of radio at the time, asked me would I do something. I said, well, how about a 24-hour broadcast of our greatest hits? So it was social, political, arty, everything else. So it ran 24 hours from midday on New Year's Eve to midday on New Year's Day. And bits of everything from John F. Kennedy to Eli Wiesel to loads of people.
It was incredible. Incredible. Okay, I'm talking to Brendan Bob. Brendan's with us for the next hour at this stage, talking and reminiscing and sharing with us some of his favourite moments from RT Radio, effectively. If you have your own favourite moment, let us know. We might not get to it today, but we will later on, because such already you can see is the popularity of this item on the Bank Holiday Friday that we might do this again. Okay, 51551 Nick DeLava.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
And Joe at RT.ie here with Brendan Boss, picking his selection of highlights from RT Radio, given the importance of all radio, provincial, national music at this particular time. By the way, Kevin Reynolds of our drama department points out, as I mentioned, Brendan did that marathon 24-hour broadcast from midday on New Year's Eve 1999 to midday on New Year's Day. Incredible, incredible stuff. But anyway, on June the 16th, obviously Bloomsday, the complete 1982 production, all 29 hours and 45 minutes of James Joyce's Ulysses would be broadcast on RT Radio 1 Extra, which is a worldwide digital channel. It will start at 8 a.m., on the 16th and finish at 3 p.m. on the 17th. It's you've heard that, Brendan. It's incredible production.
Super.
It's a dramatised reading, so to speak. It's not the best way.
It is.
All the great voices. Yeah. Benny Caulfield and
the dialogue is acted out.
Joe Taylor, yes. It's so. And there will be a new website. So that's another RTE radio offering in the next few weeks. Okay, John Skehan, Brendan.
John Skehan, one of my announcer colleagues, had been an army man during the war, and there's a bit coming up. And remember when the Nelson Pillar was blown up in March 1966. I happened to be the announcer, and I had to convince the Gardaí, and I have to go in into the GPO. No, you can't go in there.
Oh, because right beside the GPO.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that.
Bits falling off, you see. You can't go in. Well, they can't open the station. Now, how would anyone know? I knew nothing until I saw the pillar gone.
Yeah. So there it was, gone.
And I was very tempted to say from a Nelson Pillar less GPO, but I let Charles Mitchell say it in the newsroom in Donnybrook. Anyway, after that, radio, it was RT then, issued us all with identity passes to get past the security. Around Easter weekend, and I was on,
which was shortly thereafter.
I remember being on Saturday, and John Skehan was on Easter Sunday night. and a lovely voice, and as I say, an ex-army man. And he was sitting there doing the announcements and then having a little sleep because he had a touch of narcolepsy. He used to nod off at the most inappropriate moments, sometimes during an interview, I have to say, once in a while. But anyway, this man came into the continuity studio. Now, the continuity studio is the far end of the corridor, a 100-yard corridor. It's the length of Henry Street down as far as Moor Street. So that's the distance. That's the corridor. And this man came in and he looked like someone from Central Casting. He had got a fedora and a trench coat and a sort of a suspicious bulge under the armpit. And he said, what can I do for you? He said, I'll tell you what you can do for me, said this guy. I've just come in off Henry Street, past four guards and two army men with Bren guns and said, where is the announcer studio? Up the lift, sir, third floor. Came up here to the desk, the reception desk in Reddy, right? Where's the continuity studio, the one that overrides all programmes and it's always on? So, end of the corridor, second and last door. Two special branch men outside here nodded me in. Yeah. I said to the engineer there, where's the announcer? Through that door. I said, and here I am. He said, what would you do, he said, what would you do if I was an IRA man and came in here with a gun? What would you do? And John said, well, I'd move over and show you how to work this.
And remember, Brendan, in my time, there was an armed special branch man sat every day in radio reception.
That's right.
And outside relatively recently.
And outside the newsroom over in Montrose, where the newsroom comes from.
That was just to try and stop us getting in, I suspect. Right. But anyway, okay, this is John Skeehan. Go ahead.
Let me say straight off that I don't believe in ghosts, nor have I ever suffered from hallucinations. And things that go bump in the night are usually, I find, knocked over by cats. And having established that, let me tell you about the ghost I did see. Now, this is fact, not fiction. And it embarrasses me because I know what I saw, and I know such things don't exist. I was a young soldier at the time, well used to being on my own at night time, visiting patrols and outposts at all hours and in all weathers. I was stationed at Erlen Moor, a radio station close to Shannon Airport. Of course, Shannon wasn't the hub of the world in those days. It housed just a few planes and flying boats. There was a war on and transport was restricted. So on my nights off, I used to take a bicycle to ride the 14 miles to Ennis, the county town of Clare. Usually, I would get separated from my friends late in the night because, after all, there were always girls to be taken home, and that hardly qualified as a group exercise. And this meant that in the small hours of the morning, I set out alone on the road back to the airport. Now, the last few miles home were across bogland, flat, featureless terrain devoid of trees, buildings, or telegraph poles. In fact, everything that grew there was stunted and windblown. And from constant use of the road, I knew every bush and pool of water. Nothing out of the ordinary had ever happened to me on 100 such trips, nor did I ever expect anything of the sort. It happened in February, on a moonlit, windless night. At about 2:30 in the morning, I turned onto the bog road, having already covered about 10 miles. There was nothing on my mind. I was tired, relaxed. If I was thinking at all, it was of the girl I had left behind me in Ennis. Now, as I came near home, I had to pass an intricate S-bend where the road crossed and recrossed a stream. As I came to this bend, I looked up and instantly froze. I know that's a figure of speech, but I literally froze. It was as if I had stepped into an icebox. And I could feel something that I had never believed could happen. I could feel the hair standing straight up on my head. At the side of the road, where normally there wasn't even a bush, there was a monstrous apparition. It was a man dressed in a long black cloak and wearing the flat, wide-brimmed type of hat that Spanish grandees are pictured in. Nothing extraordinary about that. But this figure was about 9 feet tall. A menacing, foreboding presence. He seemed to be straining to reach out into the road. And there was something else. The figure didn't have eyes, at least in the conventional sense. There were two orbs set in the face, blood-colored, glowing like coals, flickering and bubbling. Well, I didn't have time to be either brave or cowardly. I was caught in a terror so intense that I could do nothing. I had stopped pedaling coming into the bend, and now I was incapable of stirring a muscle. As the bike slowly approached the thing, whatever it was, it seemed to be making further frantic efforts to reach out to me. Well, the whole business must have happened in seconds, but it seemed like a long minute before momentum brought me level with the apparition. I never took my eyes off it, and I felt sure somehow that it was going to break whatever bond was holding it and fall on me as I went by. When I did get past, the figure turned jerkily and looked after me. That is, if looked is the right word for the stare of those bloody eyes. I suddenly recovered the power of my legs and galvanized. I'm sure I put up new world figures for the time it took me to reach the camp. I never did get an explanation for it. My messmates laughed and talked about one drink too many. The neighboring farmers said nothing had ever been seen at that S-bend and nothing had ever happened there. Except, that's right, years ago, a young man had been thrown out of a horse-drawn trap at that spot and had drowned in the stream. But I don't know. Years later, I found out that what I had seen was one of the classical forms assumed by the Pooka, one of the oldest recorded of all the Irish ghosts. Which is very strange because, as I said, I don't believe in them anyway. But I can take you to the exact spot where that thing stood, any time you like.
And that is a true story told by John Skeen, Brendan.
He told me the story over a drink and said, you must record that. Give it to record it for me. And he did. And I put it on the plane. I put it on the airlings.
Okay, these are not recordings. These are live bloopers from the newsroom.
Yes, these are, even though it's a very serious business, giving the news out, it's sometimes not quite as serious as that. There's a few of them here. Let me just do them in reverse order. At the end, Barry Linnane in a pub in Uri trying to give a report into the newsroom with a minor bird in the background.
Okay.
Before that, Morris O'Doherty and Brendan Keenan. Now, Morris read the bulletin and Brendan Keenan was doing a report. And Morris explains it in a second.
Okay.
And Charles Mitchell not quite getting the difference between provincial and provisional.
Yeah.
And then starting with Morris O'Doherty and showing where a slight pause can be very, very meaningful.
Uganda's President Idi Amin is reported to have told an American woman reporter that he is on a belated honeymoon with his fourth wife and trying his best to stay out of the news.
The time is 6:30, and here is the news read by Charles Mitchell. The British Army has welcomed the provincial IRA's temporary ceasefire.
Now, with provisional parade, a review of the weekly newspapers, and here is George Burrow.
The 6:30 news had become a full half hour with features at the end of it. So I finished my bit and I sat back in the chair. As I leaned back, one of the casters, there were three casters on the chair and the back one was missing. I leaned back, not completely unthinkingly, and the caster, of course, was not there. So I just kept going, crashed on my back on the thing. I couldn't move because if I moved, I would have compounded the situation by making even more noise than I had. My right arm was trapped under the back of the chair. So Brendan gallantly kept going for about 30 seconds, maybe 40 seconds, and then began to titter, and the whole thing descended into a complete farce.
In San Francisco, the trial of Patty Hearst continues this week, surrounded by all the trappings of a spectacular entertainment. The young heiress, who's said to have turned urban guerrilla, appears to have won over the hearts of the American public. And it's now widely speculated that she will in fact be set free after what has been billed as the trial of the century. Reporter Chris Weicker has been covering the case in San Francisco. Dick Hogan put it to her that it had become more a farce than a serious search for justice.
There is growing bitterness here in Uri this evening. There is growing bitterness here in Uri this evening over... They claim this... Hello? There is growing bitterness here in Uri this evening over conflicting accounts of how the two... Oh,
brilliant. Now, I mentioned, listen, Rob Canning, who's brilliant work in our radio archives, has brought to our attention this piece, Brendan. It's Jerry Ryan, the late great Jerry Ryan, and he's interviewing. I was going to say do it as a quiz, but I want people to know who it is. It is a 10-year-old Saoirse Ronan, who will be on the Late Late tonight, by the way, by Skype, I presume. A 10-year-old Saoirse Ronan entering a competition on the Jerry Ryan Show. And here it is.
Now, Saoirse is 10 years of age.
Yeah.
A big Shrek fan. Looking forward to the new Shrek 2 movie, yeah?
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah, so it'll be on release on Friday.
Yeah.
Now, which character have you chosen?
I'm going to do the gingerbread man.
And you're going to make your case as to why you should win the prize.
Okay.
Off you go, Saoirse.
Okay. Hiya, Jerry. The reason why I need a holiday is because I've never had a holiday before. My mom works so hard, and my dad tried to get a part in Trek 2, but they wouldn't give it to him, Jerry, because he wasn't a big enough cookie. That's why I need a holiday, Jerry. Oh, please, Jerry. I can't stay alone with all these maniacs. I just have to get a holiday, Jerry. Never before in my life have I had a holiday. I've been in school and all the kids have gone on holiday. Told me all about it, brought back pictures and postcards, presents and all. And I never got to go anywhere. So please, Jerry, please let me go on holiday.
Very good, Saoirse. Well done.
Thank you.
And you didn't even have to resort to the fear that somebody was going to bite your head off or your leg if you didn't get out of the jurisdiction soon. Very good. Great performance. Well done.
Thank you.
Okay. Enjoy the rest of your day. Saoirse Ronan, good morning to you.
Hi, Jerry.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Now, you were with us last week, weren't you?
Yeah.
The beginning of the week. It was Monday, was it?
Yeah, it was Monday.
Yeah. Can you remember the characters that you did for us?
Yeah, I did the gingerbread man.
You did. You did a very good gingerbread man too, didn't you?
Yeah, thanks, Jerry.
Yes, you were very, very good indeed. Who helped you out?
My mammy helped me out.
Your mammy?
Yeah.
What's her name?
Monica.
Monica. Who else is in the family?
My dad and my dog, Sassy.
So you've got your dad and your dog?
Yeah.
And your mammy?
Yeah.
Are you the only little girl in the house, are you?
Yeah.
Well, have you ever been to America?
Well, I was actually born in New York, but I've never been to Florida.
You were born in New York?
Yeah.
Where are you?
Yeah.
Wow. Are your parents American?
No, they're Irish.
They're Irish?
Yeah.
And have you been back since?
No.
No?
No.
No. Well, I've got news for you.
Yeah?
Very good news. You're going to Florida.
That's superb radio at its best. Jerry with a 10-year-old Saoirse Ronan. Fantastic, fantastic.
That's lovely.
Okay, rural electrification comes to Bansha, Brendan Balf. You do the whole social history.
Yeah, because it's a bit like the ball bands these days. People have to write. And this sort of captures the feeling there. This features, of all people, John Cannon Hayes, later the founder of Muintir na Tíre.
Okay.
And he's the priest in working this here for us. And after that, you'll hear a bit from the Fit Up Touring Companies, which are at the same sort of time, 50s, Hal Roach and Cyril Cusack recall their times. But first, the rural electrification of Bansha.
We are here tonight celebrating a most important occasion, rural electrification for the parish of Bansha. Tonight, we intend to switch on the lights for this village. And I must say that it was your own cooperation and your own enthusiasm that has won for you this great gift that will not merely help you from an economic point of view, but will help too, with God's help, the social life of the parish. Now, we will switch on the lights for Bansha, and here goes in the name of God.
The event of a little show coming to town was incredible. I mean, you got such a welcome. And of course, the people, it would depend, of course, on the threshing, you know, the working on the land. Sometimes at 10 o'clock, there'd be nobody in the hall, you see. And also, we had to take turns of sweeping the hall, by the way. Everybody had to do their little job of sweeping the hall. But there'd be nobody perhaps in. And then about 11 o'clock, you'd see little figures beginning to appear over the hill. the mountain, walking miles maybe and cycling to come in. And they sit down on long ferns. Some of them used to stand and at the back of the tent, at the back of the hall, and some of them used to bring in stones, big stones from the field, and sit on the stones, by the way, and get totally carried away. And the prices, I remember, was sixpence, a shilling, and 1 and 3, whatever. And they'd come in there, and they'd be taken away, away from reality for a little while.
And, of course, the old reliable to East Lynn. And that was the very first thing I did in what might be called legitimate theatre, when I played Little Willie. I was then about 8, I suppose. And I remember it very well because there was a little boy called Arthur Ivers. Larry was his father. And he was to have played Little Willie and he fell ill. So I undertook the part at very short notice. My mother was playing Lady Isabel. And I remember so well at the end when I'm in the cot and dying, consumptive child. Very fat I was at that time for a consumptive child. And I remember so well feeling my mother's tears dropping on my face at the end of the play. That's when she says the famous line, Daddy never called me mother, you know that one.
Willie, please look at me. Can't you see I'm your very own mama? Please, Willie.
Look, I see a bright light shining. Mama, mama. I am coming.
Why, Willie, speak to me. Why, how cold he is, and how glassy his eyes are. Can this be death, I wonder? Oh, Father in heaven, is there anything else you can take from me now? My boy is dead, dead, and never called me mother.
It was quite acceptable for somebody to be in a play playing a very serious part, by the way. And the tilly lamps would only last a half an hour. They'd need repumping, you see. And it was nothing for a guy saying, and do you remember, Lady Isabel, 'twas a night such as this we drove to Richmond together, and of all the vain, capricious women, and so on, and suddenly the lamp would go, and they'd say, pardon me, my dear, walk off stage, bring on the step ladder, the steps, listen to this, pump the lamp, come down, fold the steps, bring it off, walk on and say, and now, my dear, as I was saying. No, this was all quite acceptable.
With us. Brendan Baff is still with us. We are going through various his radio highlights. By the way, that was talking about rural electrification. People will find it hard to believe that we didn't always have electricity in Ireland. And the last house to be connected to the national grid, electricity wise, was in 1978, friends. It began in 1927. And I've just tweeted a fantastic graphic from ESB Archives. I've tweeted it on at Joe Liveline and at RTE Liveline. And you can click on this map and you would see when your village or suburb in Dublin or suburb in Cork or Limerick, when they were actually connected to, when they got electricity. And it's a fascinating piece. Okay, more from Brendan Balfe after this break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
By the way, I'm with Brendan Balfe. Brendan Balfe produced, with RTE, of course, a 3-CD set called The Irish Voice. It was based on 12 one-hour programmes he did. I wish they were rebroadcast maybe over the summer if this world continues in the way it is. It's called The Irish Voice, Ireland on the Radio. And the number of people who are contacting us to say that they actually took out this 3-CD piece, and have been playing it over and over again in their cocoon. It's a magnificent compilation. Now, Brendan's favourite comedian, I'm told, is Mr. Stan Freeberg. Brendan will talk after this broadcast, after this clip of how he met Stan Freeberg in Hollywood. And this is called Elderly Man River.
Well, it's great to be with you tonight. We have a
Pardon me, Mr. Freeberg, but my name is Tweedley.
Well, we all have our problems.
I am the censor from the Citizens Radio Committee, and I feel...
You, from the Citizens Radio Committee, you say?
That's exactly what I said, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what is your purpose in being here?
I must okay all the material used on your program here, and I think the best method is to just sit back here and interrupt when I feel it's necessary.
You mean you plan to stop me every time I do something that you think is wrong?
Exactly. I'll just sound my little horn like this. And then you stop, and I'll tell you what's wrong.
Somehow I can tell this is going to be one of those days.
You just go right ahead, Mr. Freeberg. Don't mind me.
Yeah, now I'd like to sing...
You forgot to say thank you, Mr. Freeberg. Politeness is an essential in radio programming. Your program goes into the home. We must be a good influence on children.
That's a darling little horn there. Thanks very much, Mr. Tweedley.
You're welcome, I'm sure.
I'd like to sing a old river song in honor this week of National Mississippi Riverboat Paddle Wheel Week. Mr. May, if you please.
Very polite, Mr. Freeberg.
Thank you.
Old Man River, that old...
All right, Tweedley, politeness I dig, but what in the world is wrong with Old Man River?
The word old has a connotation some of the more elderly people find distasteful. I would suggest you make the substitution, please.
I suppose you insist?
Precisely. You may continue.
Okay, music.
You forgot to say thank you.
Yes, okay. Thank you, Mr. Tweedley.
You're quite welcome, I am sure.
Elderly man river, that elderly man river, he must know something, but he don't say nothing.
All right, hold it, fellas. Now what, Tweedley?
The word something, you left off the G.
But that's authentic. Something. Something. That's the way the people talk down there.
What? The home is a classroom, Mr. Freeberg.
I know you said that.
Keep in mind the tiny tots. And furthermore, think back. You'll recall that you said, but he don't say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, really, Mr. Freeberg, that's a double negative. Do you mean he does say something?
No, I just wasn't using my head, I guess.
I mean, after all, it should be grammatically correct, keeping in mind...
Mind the tiny tots, yes.
You probably mean he doesn't say anything.
I suppose I mean that, yes, I guess. All right, fine, you win. All right, Billy, music. Thank you.
You're welcome, I am sure.
Elderly man river, that elderly man river, he must know something, but he doesn't say anything. He just keeps rolling, rolling. He just keeps rolling along. He doesn't plant taters, potatoes. He doesn't plant cotton, cotting. And them, these, those that plants them are soon forgotting. But every man river, just keep rolling along.
Excellent.
Thank you.
You and me.
The tiny tots again, was it?
Exactly.
Sorry about that. Here we go. Got by that one.
Hold that part! Lift that veil!
You get a little.
Okay, take your finger off the button, Mr. Tweedley. We know when we're licked. Well, that concludes Elderly Man River. Oh, yes, and thank you for being with us, Mr. Tweedley.
You're welcome, I'm sure.
What's that? Would the orchestra have been live there?
Billy May, yeah, his great friend, and Stan Freeberg. And Stan Freeberg was a good singer. He could do things like that. He always, that particular cut. I played on the radio years ago, and Oliver Barry, our mutual friend, was driving along the country road, and he burst out laughing and got in a fit of paroxysms and crashed into a tree.
Oh, God. Okay, and, obviously, because he's around still.
And I told this. I met Stan Freberg in Hollywood some years ago, and I told him that. I said, that's nothing. He said, I remember the people who wrote a book of lists? There was a thing out there some years ago, the book of lists.
Yeah.
And they were doing a list on people who died laughing. And they came to Stan Freberg and said, do you know we have evidence of somebody who died laughing? Wow. With what? What happened? Well, it was apparently a daughter told us, and her elderly father died. He had a very bad heart and was very, very sick. And he happened to be laughing to this, and he passed away while listening to this. Freberg said, and the ambulance man had the bad grace to ask him, what track was it he was listening to?
Can we? Okay, Rock and Roll Comes to Ireland. That was 1956.
56. Fabulous. I mean, I think of all the programmes I've done of a slightly cultural or societal element, I've managed to get this into every one of them. I think it's a fabulous piece because it's a total game changer. It marks the beginning of a different era completely, down to one particular 2.5-minute piece by Kevin O'Kelly. Superb report. He was, as you know, he was the religious core in later years. And did he go to jail for the stiff arm thing?
IRA.
But he did this for a City Newsreel, August 56. The film was in the Carlton Cinema, and Ireland went into the history books by having the very first rock and roll riot in Europe because we got the movie before London by a day or two. So here is the famous example of Kevin O'Kelly and Rock Around the Clock in the Carlton Cinema.
Rock and roll had arrived. The film played Dublin in the middle of August to an audience of enthusiastic but eminently respectable devotees of the newest new music.
While another one burned my brain. Two girls gave me my money. Two girls made me my clothes.
But word got around. Before long, in some cinemas, it was the furniture that began to roll and rock. As one cinema manager found out,
It took, I think, about 5 minutes for that crowd to change from being a very good-humoured lot into a collection of blackguards. And, of course, they were all very sorry the following day and they were all back to apologise, but that didn't remedy the damage that had been done. And as in every crowd, there's a small element of outright blackguards who want to use the occasion for wreckage.
But the wreckers are few. Most fans deplore this conduct. You should take rock and roll seriously. It's quite different from just bopping. Let an expert explain.
You've seen the Dixieland band. They'd be doing bopping. If they played rock and roll, they'd do the same steps. There's no difference here. But in England there is. In London now, for instance, I was in London there for a while. And that's where they do rock and roll. And they have the partners in London, rock and roll. And it's really great to watch it. Marvellous. It's the way they do the splits in the air and rolling across the shoulders and all of that, you know, and doing the splits and everything like that.
Fans say that Oranor would cause no trouble if the dance halls would only let it alone. They say suspicion of it colours their mildest activities.
I was thrown out of another dance hall for that, for doing the Charleston. I was told there was jiving in it. And, well, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't jiving, it was only just doing the Charleston down there, as I was taught it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they come along and they said, oh, Charleston, not at all, that's not Charleston. He says, that's jiving. And when they tell you that's jiving, well, you can't object to them and you can't say they're wrong because they just tell you out the door.
Well, how about rock and roll? Do you think it's here to stay?
I think it is, and it'll catch on, and it'll catch on fast.
And how wrong he was. Back after this break, 51551 Nick DeLava.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
I'm talking about rock and roll the man, the show band man, the Royal Show Band, the Big Eight, 5 number one hits in Ireland. Brendan Boyer died in the last 24 hours. And apparently the Royal Show Band were so big at one stage that before the Beatles hit the national psyche, the international psyche, in 1962. They opened for the Royal Show Band at a performance in Liverpool.
That's right.
And then Brendan O'Brien went to Las Vegas, didn't he?
Well, over many years after that, yeah. When the Royal he left the Royal Show Band to become part of the Big Eight, isn't that
okay?
Kind of?
Yeah, yeah.
And then a lot of work in Las Vegas, and they were in the Stardust Club for years and years and years.
So there was Twink Paddy Cole did. Then they went to Vegas.
Yeah, went to Vegas. Yeah, yeah.
And Brendan did Elvis impersonations.
That's right.
Which Elvis?
Right. Yeah.
Loved
I was in court over it because I remember I interviewed Brendan Boyer. And say, I'm leaving the Royal Show Band to go to the Big Eight. And there was a court case about the two managements were at each other's throats.
Okay.
And I was brought to court to say, did Brendan Boyer say he was leaving? Yes, he did. And I was there for 10 days waiting to be called to say, yes, he said that to me. Yeah. Thank you.
Anyway, he's passed. He was one of the greats. Terry Wogan, Brendan Ballard.
One more thing. Speaking of Brendan and the Big Eight, the Elvis connection. Elvis came to see the show and gave him a few songs, etc. And asked them back to Elvis's Ritz palace upstairs on the top floor of the nightclub. Yeah. And he brought the band and the two Hucklebuck girls, one of whom was Rita. And Rita was there and having a drink and enjoying herself no end. And Brendan was talking to Elvis on the couch. And Elvis was saying, well, I do the movies, brother. I don't think I'm a great actor. And the movies aren't great. And I don't enjoy doing them. And I don't think I'm a great actor. And Rita passed. Ah, Jesus, Elvis, you're very hard on yourself.
Terry Wogan.
Terry Wogan, yes. As I said, chief announcer. He sort of half-trained me. When he left the staff to go freelance and to go to the BBC, he did a couple of sponsored programmes here in Ireland as well. And I produced this one for, as it happened, Oliver Barry, international artist, who managed the Freshman, Sean Dunphy, and the Wolftones. And I remember speaking to the Wolftones, I said, would you please stop referring to our fans as Wolftones sympathisers? Sorry. Nonetheless, we tried to make this sound like a sort of a Radio Caroline, noisy pop show. And that follows with three fairly well-known voices doing a rap about the new programmes. And Radio Ram was turning just nicely into a bit of a pop station. Not very much. There were only 3 or 4 hours. But
this was a rap before there was rap.
Exactly. Anyway, let's hear. Here's Terry with Take It From Terry.
I wonder if you're lonesome, Nanny. You know, someone said music hath charms. Music is charming. Terry Wogan, well...
Get off! You're listening to a track from the best-selling Knockout LP by the Freshmen, Moving On. Things get better! Ah, those fabulous Freshmen, Things Get Better.
All right, then. Anybody, any suggestions for the program?
Well, let's run up the flag and see if anybody salutes, eh?
Out with the dance diaries. These are the dates and the places for the Freshmen. Tomorrow night, it's Virginia. On Thursday, Sea Point Ballroom in Galway. On Friday, Strand Hill, Derry. On Saturday night, Black Rock Dundalk on Sunday. And this night week, you can hear and groove to the Freshmen in the Arcadia Cork.
May I have this dance?
Well, I'm a little stiff from bowling.
I don't care where you're from. Let's dance.
The Wolftones on Thursday are appearing in the Miami concert in the Adelphi Cinema in Dublin. On Monday night, it's the Old Sheeling and Carpenter's Carlo. You can hear the Wolftones this night week.
Ooh, this is John Drummond. Break my mind. Okay. What are you waiting for, John?
Baby. Oh, baby. Tell the man. The ticket stand, let you change your mind.
Hi there, popsters. You'll be glad to hear I've a show on Thursday that'll bring you cheer. Charts and new releases, hits from overseas.
This is marvelous, really, Larry.
Just a Gogan, Mr. B.
It's an RTE, it's an RTE. Remember, it's a radio and not TV. If the
the best sounds of pop are what you crave. We're on VHS. Medium wave. Well, the bright spot on Mondays, I have no doubt, will be when I do my thing and let it all hang out. With show bands and the beat loops and the new LPs.
On the wireless, is it Brendan?
On the belt beat, Mr. G.
It's on RTE, RTE. Remember, it's a radio and not TV. If the best sounds of pop are what you crave, we're on VHS.
I'd like to get a word in, if I might. I'll be doing pop call every Wednesday night, and on Fridays I'll have country style for Western fans.
You mean you'll have two shows?
Well, damn's the plan.
It's on RTE, RTE. Remember, it's a radio and not...
Brilliant. Who's doing the music, Brandon?
John Keogh and the Green Beats. Every expense was spared.
It's superbly put together. That is really
That was
super.
Just for the pop shows.
Your voice was in there. Okay, Gayborn.
Gayborn.
On the day that the Evening Herald today have a fantastic supplement.
Isn't it super? I was looking at it.
It's about 12 pages long. Of Gay's columns from the Evening Herald. As you know, he wrote Sunday World and then the Sunday Independent. And he loved writing and he was a really fluent, really good. He wrote as he spoke. Which
very
was
much so. He spoke, in paragraphs.
Yeah, and he was very proud of his writing. But anyway, that's just a by the by. He's in the lovely supplement. I think they're doing it for the next 3 weeks. Anyway, Gayborn and Malachy Scully.
Well, I better set it up because I was producing Gay for many, many years on sponsored programmes. Yeah. I hired him when I was 19 years of age. And because I had been asked to the program, and would you get Gayborn to do it? I said, certainly. And so I rang him. I was at the first Late Late Show. Did I say that to you?
Yeah, you were in the audience.
Yeah, I was in the audience, yeah. And
what age were you then, Brandon?
I was 16.
And how were you in the audience the first Late Late Show?
Because a placard came up on Telefiche Sharon, as it was then. Yeah. Say, audience required two nights, Studio One, Montrose, come as you are type of thing. No tickets required. And it was the first Late Late Show. And we were so, I remember two pals of mine, Phil Hannigan and Des Connolly, and we were so impressed by, we knew Gabe because he'd been on radio and said, here's somebody who sounds vaguely human, you know, almost a DJ and not sort of a stiff person. And we were looking at cameras and lights and who's he, what's he doing, what's happening here? And the show was fine. It was Verona Mullen, Liam O'Brien.
And it was live, obviously. Yeah, it was always a great. Yeah.
And we came back week in, week out. And so I got to know him over the time. And I eventually was my... I'd started in radio shortly after. That was 62. So I was in radio since 64. And I eventually got asked by the ad agency to do this sponsored program.
Okay.
And get Gator. So I had to ring him up at age 19 and offer him a gig. For 12 guineas, if I remember correctly, which probably went to his accountant, so we never saw it.
Never saw it.
And it was the Ernie Mystery Parcel where people sent stuff in and we played records for them.
Okay, and the sponsor program were 15-minute programs.
Yeah. And there was 40.
IMCO and Glen Abbey and a different company would sponsor each one. That was the way
this
they
one,
did it.
And this one here was, it was the first phone-in, well, it wasn't phone-in, it was phone-out program.
Okay.
Because they couldn't ring us, we had to ring them.
Yeah.
And it was the Albright and Wilson program and Gay rang Housewives and chatted to them and played a record for them.
Okay.
And one day, and they wrote into us and we rang them back on the recording day on a Monday. And one Monday, we having no luck, we rang 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 phone calls and nobody was here. We couldn't get the line.
Okay.
We're running out of time. We've got to go. And I said, a friend of mine, Tony Gaynor, who was a producer in Radyware and in GPO at that time, takes on this old Dublin man thing that he does. He says, at the pub bore, you know, it's all this Appenbombs. That's not doing the weather. Said, it's all these people and just complaining, a general moan. So I said, if we rang you, would you take on that and sort of pretend that you're a plumber and Gay got you by accident?
Okay.
And that's how it starts. So I was named Malachy Scully, the first name came to my head. He was a plumber working in Mrs. O'Brien's house. And we came back to him every now and again you again? Yeah, oh, here we are. So in this case here, talking to Gay, and as we were about to record, it was the morning, the weekend after the very first Eurovision Song Contest in the Gaiety.
When it was happening.
Been happening. And we were about to start recording, and the phone rang in. Here it is.
Hello?
Hello, Gable.
Yes?
Are you here for lunch?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes.
So long as I know, Pat.
Righto.
Bye.
Goodbye. Who's that? Albright and Wilson calling you if you're lucky.
Do you know what it is? They spent, I saw on the paper, they spent something like £3.5 million doing the song contest.
No, well, yeah, well, that, like yeah, a little more, yes.
Well, I was watching it. I was watching it in colour.
Yes.
I don't know what it was, but it was one of the local, and I was watching it in colour. Do you know what it is? Those men, those women, there's a Mrs. Gray sings in our poop.
Yeah.
And do you know what it is? She'd make a show of Best Part of that Creole.
Go away.
She couldn't sing at all.
Go away.
She couldn't understand a word half of them were saying.
And what do you think, what sort of songs does she sing, Mrs. Gray, I mean?
Oh, she sings now the good songs, the songs that last.
Yeah.
The songs that last.
Yeah.
Things like My September Love.
Yes.
You know that one? Yeah. I remember yes. My September Love.
Oh, very good. You know, yes, yes. And You Are the One.
You Are the One. Without a Song. Do you know Without a Song?
Without a Song, yes, I do.
Without a Song. That's last thing.
Yeah.
She sings...
But would she be good? Would she be good in colour, Mr. Scully? Mrs. Gray?
In colour?
Yes. You saw
colour.
The... you saw the contest in colour, yes.
Oh, on the telly, you
yes,
saying.
Yes. Would
oh,
she
God,
be good
I thought you had me working.
No, I mean, would she be good in colour, you know?
Listen, these people are... she's a very nice woman. She can look very well.
Yes.
You know, now, if provided like she knew you were going to do it.
Yes.
You know, she could sort of dicky herself up.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
She can look well. She can look well. I've seen her now looking very well.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, she's only a working woman now. She's not one of these models you see around.
Yes.
Like, you know,
yes.
Mom mating a crutch. I mean, she's a fine, big, healthy-looking woman.
Yes.
But she look well, I think, all
yeah.
Right. But she's only one of many. There's more singers in there. They only get a chance. They never get a chance.
Yes, I know. Yes.
No, never get, there's a fella there who sings Jim Reeves songs.
Yes.
Little fella.
Yes.
Crooked Paddy, they call him.
Yes.
But it's not joking you. If you heard that fella, that doesn't be a dry eye at the place. You'd listen to him, man. You'd never get tired of
this. This is Crooked
Paddy. Morning, noon. Crooked
this is Crooked Paddy, yes.
They call him Crooked Paddy.
Yes.
His nickname he has, you see, because he has a bit of a limp in the leg, you know.
I know, yes.
But,
yes.
You'd listen to that fella singing all the beautiful.
And you think he would have done as well in the Gaiety as the people we had on?
I'm telling you, well, now, I'll tell you this much. Now, our bills are. Now, we're used to good singers up there. We're no gobs like when it comes to film. And I'll tell you that the general opinion, when they were all finished there, was that, God, you know what it is? If you get Crooked Paddy and Mrs. Gray, they'd knock that crowd into a cock castle. I mean, at least you know what they're singing about.
Exactly.
That crowd couldn't even sing in English half.
Yeah. No.
Oh, pardon the old songs. Do you remember any of the songs?
Yes.
I don't.
Yeah.
That's Tony Gaynor.
Yeah.
And where did Tony go?
He went to Rhodesia Broadcasting and then to South African Broadcasting and became an announcer, believe it or not. That was sort of near his own voice there, but a little bit of...
I remember this. They were hilarious. They were absolutely hilarious. Okay, with Brendan Balfe, 51551, wash your hands.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Looking at the list of requests that people are sending in for the radio highlights, we could go on and on and on as I say. Okay, Kathleen Walker's poetry has really, really come into itself during the pandemic, so to speak.
Very much so, very much so. And I came, not a poem here, I came across this a long time ago, but I found it again recently. Mm. And I think it describes indeed what broadcasting does sometimes when it's at its best. And really, it's by Henry David Thoreau, and he goes back a long, long time. But he said, it's something to be able to paint a particular picture or to carve a statue, and so to make a few objects beautiful. But it's far more glorious to carve and paint the very atmosphere and medium through which we look. To affect the quality of the day, that's the highest of arts. I think broadcasters do that.
Okay. So this is Affect Kathleen.
The quality of the day.
On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the grey window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colours, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours, May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life.
That was Kathleen Watkins. I'm going to finish on the voice of Brendan Baffy because he's going to read out that quote again, that beautiful quote about the quality of the day, and it's dedicated to everyone at the moment, including frontline, including those who are delivering our milk and delivering our bread and baking our bread. Today's BCO is Elaine Conlon, Nicky Dempsey on sound, research by Richie Byrne, Angus McAnally produced, and Ray Darcy will be next. And this is the beautiful voice to finish the programme and the incredible memory and achievements of Mr. Brendan Balfe.
By Thoreau, it's something to be able to paint a particular picture or to carve a statue and so to make a few objects beautiful. But it's far more glorious to carve and paint the very atmosphere and medium through which we look, to affect the quality of the day. That is the highest of arts.